Hello, and welcome to the Rooted in Reliability podcast, your plant performance podcast, where we dive deeper into asset management techniques and know-how. I'm your host, James Kovacevic, and I will be your guide to achieving industry best practice. The Rooted in Reliability podcast is here to provide you with the insights to improve plant performance and deliver bottom-line results to your organization. In case you missed the last episode, you can find the Rooted in Reliability podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, and on the reliability.fm network. Don't forget to subscribe so you'll never miss an episode. Now let's dive into today's topic. It is my pleasure to welcome back Fred Schenkelberg. Welcome back, Fred.
Hey, James. Glad to be back.
Excellent. So, you know, I understand you know, not recently, but somewhat recently, you purchased a new house.
That's right. And almost a year ago.
And you were mentioning, prior to starting the call, that you're replacing windows. I know you previously did some stuff with plumbing and all these other things keep coming up with this new house.
It's not new.
So
it's about 40 years old. And it was a custom built home here in the woods. And so the windows in particular, this last winter, we had some pretty hard driving rains and noticed that these windows along the top ridge of the house leaked. If you got enough water on them and blowing at it, it just came right through. So we needed to fix that. And so they're single pane windows. The caulking on them is all gone, basically. It's all dried out and cracked and is not really useful anymore. And instead of taking apart the windows and re-caulking them, and because the wood would continue to be damaged, there was no flashing on the windows either. We decided to get double pane windows installed and install them correctly with flashing and the proper caulking and all that good stuff. So they've got scaffolding set up. It's an A-frame house, and there's a ridge along the top that has all these windows. And so there's scaffolding set up in the middle of our upstairs, and they're rolling it back and forth as they work on the different windows. But it's quite an investment to maintain the house, if you think of it that way.
Yeah, absolutely. And that all goes to, you know, your total cost of ownership. When you bought the house, you had your upfront price, but now you got all these asset extending activities that you're now doing to make sure that your house will last you for the next 30, 40, 50 years without issue.
Well, we fully suspect there's going to be more issues. But and, you know, it's an analogy for a plant, right? Or a piece of equipment in your factory. We have to pay utilities, right? And we have, between gas and electric and garbage and stuff like that, just for the day-to-day maintenance and operation of the facility, the house. But then, like, there's upgrades. We wanted to, well, it's a mix of an upgrade and a repair. Now, we could have maybe just caulked those windows and hope for the best. Yet, when we looked at it and considered the options, the amount of work to do that versus get the upgraded windows installed with the benefit of being able, because none of the windows at the top of the ridge opened. So we had no venting at the top of the house. And so we added windows we could open, and they're double pane, so it'll hold heat in the winter, and it'll keep heat out during the summer, things like that. So we think we'll get some energy benefits out of it and some comfort benefits, a better performance, but then also stop the damage that's occurring from the water ingress. So it's a bit of maintenance and a bit of upgrade, yeah, kind of mixed into that. But you're right, it's something we're hoping we don't want to replace windows every year. That's
no,
for sure.
Absolutely not. But all this, when we were talking about this, it all made me think about life cycle costing, because that's essentially what it is. And you just mentioned, do we go with higher efficiency windows, reduce heating, cooling costs, create some comfort there? Can we open it so we can vent? All these things, these are trade-offs to, do we replace it like you're doing now with your windows? Do mm-hmm. we just repair it like you could have done by replacing the caulking, so on and so forth?
That's right.
You know, or do we just leave it and potentially have extra damage, extra failures, extra consequences, all these things? This is life cycle costing 101. isn't it?
Well, yeah, well, it's kind of even before 101, because I didn't have a spreadsheet even open. We talked about it. We considered it. We explored options with our contractors. And it was just one project and one window here. Yet, I think we could have done in... Diane doesn't. She tolerates me doing all the. You know, if I do a study or I do a calculation or do stuff that I would do for work, she doesn't mind that. But she doesn't really see the point for the projects we got around the house. But it's very similar to the types of considerations and things to think through when you're in a plant, right? It's the lights or designing a product. What's the cost of ownership, and is it worth it, is going to provide enough value in return on that investment over time. And I think I should have done a spreadsheet and did a case study of the whole thing, although it'd probably take us another 2 months to get the project done if I did that.
So with that though, what should be going into that life cycle costing model or total cost of ownership model? We have the purchase price of the asset, right?
Mm-hmm. So we got this big sink, right? You think of a horizontal line, and expenses, you draw a line down, and it's the length of the line is the magnitude of the purchase, right? And at the end of the day, you want more return. You want more lines, longer lines, or just more massive lines going up than down over time. So let's use a F-35 Joint Strike Fighter aircraft as a quick example. It costs what? I have no idea what the number is, but I think it was hundreds of millions of dollars and probably more for one aircraft, one piece of equipment.
Yep.
Right? So there's this huge initial cost. They roll it out into the tarmac, and now you have to train and hire a bunch of maintenance technicians and special tools and equipment and diagnostic equipment. So there's more expenses right up. You haven't even flown it yet. And then you fly it. So you got to put fuel in it, do all those things. Those cost money, right? Well, what is a Joint Strike Fighter benefit? What do they do that gives you money back? So it gives us peace. Again, there's an argument for that, but it's a little bit nebulous to quantify. But there's a whole lot of expenses. And then the cost of maintenance, I think, is estimated to be like 10 times the initial purchase price over the life of the aircraft. And... let's use a passenger aircraft, right? Every time they fly it, they create revenue. Yes. It's a thin profit margin, right? Because of fuel costs and maintenance and all these other things. So it's at the end of the day, that revenue has to balance it out or become profitable at some point. But the more maintenance you have to do, the more repairs you got to do, the more expensive those repairs are, the harder it is to make a profit with that equipment.
So... we have the total cost to buy the asset. We have the people, the wages for people to operate it, the wages for people to maintain it, the parts required to maintain it, the electricity, gas, oil, whatever else you use to run that asset.
That's right.
Then you have the value that's realized from it, whether that is in terms of dollars. So in the case of the aircraft, passenger aircraft, how much revenue are we driving from it? In terms of a park, for example, it may be, you know, the value people perceive from it, whatever the case is.
That's right. That's right.
Now, when we start looking at some of this stuff, how do we model out what that cost of maintenance is going to be? How do we model out the energy usage? And how do we begin to make those trade-offs? You know, going back to your house, double pane window versus single pane window. Mm-hmm, how do we start to evaluate that trade-off?
Well, I mean, at some part, it's you go find your friendly financial. I call them financial engineers, but I think they call them analysts or go to the finance team, and they have models for what's the price of energy, because they're always evaluating: do we do a bulk purchase? Do we do future contracts? Do we, especially when you're in a high energy usage type environment, like the fuel for passenger aircrafts. When fuel prices are low, they try to create these long-term contracts that locks in a low price. And sometimes they get caught and they end up in the contract runs out when they're now a price of fuel is really high, and then they get locked into contracts over the long term, because the suppliers likewise don't want to, they want to minimize their risk also. So they only offer long-term contracts. It goes back and forth. But the finance folks tend to think about, well, what's the future cost of money, right?
Net present value.
Net present value, right? You basically are saying, well, what's the inflation rate? What's the discount rate? What's the appreciation on this equipment? So it's all of these different factors, and the better ones are wizards with spreadsheets, and they can sort all that stuff out. The one part that I found that they need us for, the reliability folks, is, well, how often will it break down? How often do I need to do this kind of maintenance? And so we get some of that information from the vendor. We get some of it from our, you know, existing equipment and similar equipment and stuff like that. And then we refine that model as we actually operate the equipment. And it's one of the better reasons for keeping good track of time to failure data and what fails, and doing good diagnostics, getting good maintenance practices, so that you get good information to go back into that model. And because at some point you're going to see equipment is like my first car when I was in high school, just wear out. Right, that you're doing major repairs regularly, but unless you're keeping track of that and can sense when that's occurring, you're already too, anecdotally, you're just too deep into it, and you're already spending way too much money, and you lose the advantage of time to plan for a replacement or to bring on some another piece of equipment online before it gets out of control. And so the part of it is the finance guys deal with energy, they deal with net present value, they deal with inflation rates, discount rates, all that stuff. The reliability people bring in, well, how often and what's going to fail? And then we can sort out the cost of those things of doing that. The operations folks are going to, and systems engineers are going to say, well, what's the cost if that machine is down? If it's down for 2 minutes and we got a 5 minute buffer for materials, it's no big deal. If it's going to be down for 2 days, though, that shuts the line down. So, and here's what the cost is. And so you can factor things like that into it.
So you do factor in the cost of lost production or cost of downtime then?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Well, certainly. Like if you, now, we all realize that no piece of equipment is going to give us 100% 24/7 uptime.
No, but right? When you build your model, you may plan in 4% planned downtime for that asset, and probably maybe 2 or 3% planned downtime, unplanned downtime.
Right.
So you build into the model, and you can start to, well, if we were able to reduce planned downtime by 1%, what does that do overall over the course of 10 years of this asset?
That's right.
A little bit more upfront cost. So right. When we do these life cycle models, it's not we have one model. We have one framework for a model, but we have multiple models based on different inputs into it, correct?
That's right. And you know, one of the best systems, when you get a good model like that and you understand your equipment, and then you start doing the what-if scenarios. So the maintenance team would come to it and say, well, what if we could, here's an idea, a proposal that will shave a tenth of a percent off of our downtime if we do it, and it's going to cost us $100,000 to do it. Well, sitting in the maintenance team as a reliability engineer, I don't know what that equates to unless I know what the cost per minute of downtime is. So I need to go find somebody that knows that information. And in most factories, it gets complicated because there's a mix of products and different downtime at different times costs different amounts and so on. So I go find the finance folks and say, all right, let's use your model. What if I change this part of our system impacts your model this way? What's the result? And then you can start doing those what-if things going, well, how much of a change is going to be worth doing? Or which changes, if we have five proposals, which one's going to give us the best ROI? And you can do what-if, you can do sensitivity analysis, you can do a bunch of stuff on those to help you make good decisions about, well, where's the best place to make improvements in our program?
So what if we don't have good historical data? We're going to introduce say we're looking at a system overall, and we're going to replace this type of pump with a different efficiency or a higher grade pump. Mm-hmm, we don't have any information on that newer version that we're evaluating. How do we calculate what we're going to get in terms of that reliability improvement or that downtime improvement?
So I can think of three things right off the bat. One is the, you know, a higher efficiency pump. Maybe it's more throughput, we can produce more product, or it uses less energy. Let's say it uses less energy. And so there's one thing that's on the data sheet and from the guy selling it to you. And then there's another one of what it does in your plant, the way we operate it. And so the other part is, well, if it's a new technology of a pump or a new vendor of a pump that we don't have a history with, well, how often does it break? And how often do we need to maintain it or adjust it or align it or, you know, or just interact with this thing?
So where do you get those failure rates then?
At the start, it's you just make them up. You know, we've got thousands of pumps in the building. So let's use just that as, this is a technology. It's similar to that one over there. What's its history? And worse, it's just anecdotal from your team. They say, oh, I know that pump. I worked with one of those before. They're great or they're not. And it's little more than an educated guess in some cases.
So it's a bit of art and science in crafting these life cycle models.
Well, if you got nothing else, it doesn't mean you don't do the model. You say, hey, this was an assumption, right? Yeah. And if it turns out that assumption is critical to you making the decision, it says, you know, if I change my assumption, if I say it's going to fail three times a year, and that means, yes, we're going to buy it, and it makes great sense to do, but if it fails four times a year, it destroys the model and doesn't make sense to do it. Well, then we need to get more data. We need to spend money to analyze that or do a test or get more data from other companies that use this thing or run a pilot run and find out how it really performs. If it's critical, you need better data. If it's not critical, if it's, you know, it could be between 2 and 10 times a year and it doesn't influence the return on investment enough to change our mind, pick a number in the middle and go. You're going to have to make hundreds of assumptions. So you got to document which ones those are that you're just guessing on and then test them to determine how important they are to the overall decision you're making.
Okay, I was going to say, we talked about the assumptions in the, I think it was calculating return on investment in the previous podcast.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same thing. Call out those assumptions. Provide the relevant data behind it if people want to look at it.
That's right. And sometimes you can do it within a financial model or a return on investment or life cycle model, where you can determine that some things are pretty robust. You can change them by orders of magnitude, and they really don't influence the resulting decision, do we buy or not buy? Does this make sense? But look at the factors that contribute to that decision. It's energy usage, throughput, it's maintenance and uptime type capabilities and so on. And when it's a critical one and the maintenance or the reliability performance of this thing, or in general, there's just too many unknowns, but there's still going to be this gut feel in the group going, this still makes sense. I think it's kind of that the final test. Don't switch your whole plant and hope for the best. And I've seen this happen in plants. Is they run the new equipment on a proto line that's got intermittent use. Sometimes it's a more harsh use because it's lots of changeovers, lots of different stresses and circumstances, and they get a good feel for if they keep track. Right? If they actually do data collection and failure analysis, they get a real good sense of what works and what doesn't work. And some of those experiments may take a year or 2 years to do in order to gather enough information to know if it's worth doing or not, or they have reasonable information. But the idea is that just because you don't have data, a huge history or, you know, piles of information that answers this to the 10th decimal point, we never have that data. You know, make an assumption, make it clear that it's an assumption, do sensitivity on it to see if it's critical to the final decision. And if it's not, don't worry about it. Go on, move on.
This podcast is brought to you by Iridicio. Be sure to check out Iridicio's IBL Blended Learning for Maintenance and Reliability Professionals. This SMRP-accredited project-based curriculum will take you through all aspects of a maintenance and reliability program and provides you with all the tools you need to generate a 30 times return on investment for your organization and a set of credentials from the University of Tennessee for you. You can find out more at ibltraining.com.
Now, within these various models, you know, we talked about maybe we change this part here, so maybe we upgrade a pump and that we're looking at the overall impact on the process. I'm assuming these models then can look at and help us evaluate our repair or replace decisions. If we repair here, we can prolong the life by X. If we forego maintenance and get to this point, then we have to replace. And we can evaluate those different options as well with this type of model, correct?
Well, the financial model will help you sort that out. It's more of a physics of failure type thing, right? If you know that you've got impeller wear and or crack propagation and you're monitoring that, then, yeah, you can – if you're already doing that, then do predictive maintenance and run it closer to the edge of its useful life, right? It's just a matter of that balance between what's the chance of catastrophic failure and getting another days of production out of it. And it's – that's so dependent on the process you're doing and the system you're running and what measurements you can make. The financial models can help. If you're seeing that wear out starting, you can make a judgment as, well, what chance of failure for our next production run is unacceptable and that we're going to, let's do the repair or replace right now. And then vice versa, like you're saying, is sometimes if I do a repair, if you're tracking the effectiveness of the repairs, what's the failure rates after this repair versus what they were before? And is my rate of repair steady or is it increasing after every repair or is it decreasing after a repair? Systems can actually get better with well-done repairs and improving components and pieces on it, you know, meaning that the time between unscheduled downtime is further apart. So it's, if you're tracking the data that way, then the financial overlay of that can help you make those decisions of, well, it's running to the end of its life and we need to replace it or plan for its replacement. And we've talked about that before, though. It's hard to get all that data and keep it clean.
Yep, absolutely. And then, you know, you start to think a little bit further out. And you have all these individual models for all these different systems, and then you overlay that with a capital expenditures budget.
Yep.
And now you're trying to figure out, okay, if I replace this one, if I repair this one here, I can delay that replacement for 5 years, but that allows me to do all these upgrades on these other ones I need to do, and so on and so forth. So it's you have to start at the equipment level, understand how the life cycle costing on that is, before you can start to overlay that with your capital expenditures and optimize your spend or predict your spend accurately.
Yeah. Can you come talk to our water board? we've got some deferred maintenance that I've been just...
I think we talked about this before.
I think we've talked about this. Can you come talk to them?
All you need to do is supply the flight and maybe a couple beers, and I'll be happy to come down.
All right. You're on. Since you have a spell here with no conferences, we'll have to get you out here. But it's... It still is hard, right? We're using models. We're using, in a lot of cases, it's a set of assumptions, and then we've got sketchy data. If you look at it close enough, even with good data, there's still going to be people looking at it going, well, I only have $10 this year. We're not going to do that repair. Even though we know it's going to save us $50,000 if we wait 6 months because it'll be a rush order when it fails. Yep. You know, it just... The factors of just, we don't ever have enough money. But I think the longer term part is that as you start building these models, you start considering life cycle costs, and the model itself at first will be just a skeleton, right? And then you start figuring out what you need to measure and start populating it. And then start showing how it's useful. Start showing that it actually makes a difference, and it builds credibility in that process. It builds it up in the organization. In one group, I saw that this model, it dictated what R&D and product improvements and plant improvement projects were funded, because they had to go through the model and do a what-if analysis. What if we made these changes? Here's this, and they had some criteria to judge assumptions. And the results of the return on investment was the deciding factor of what got funded. It was a major contributor to what projects went forward and what didn't. And it was all the way up to the board level of the organization for some major, major projects that all went through this model. But it took them 10 years to get it refined and understood and accepted throughout the organization as being really accurate and really useful tool for them. And so it became exceedingly powerful for them.
Absolutely. But that's where we want to get to. We want to accurately predict what our life cycle costs are. What is our OPEX, operational budget, operational expenditures, your CAPEX or capital expenditure budget, and start predicting those 2, 3, 5, 10 years down the road. So you know when you're going to make those trade-offs to repair, delay repair and replace later, and all those other things, right?
Yeah, and it's more important on the big ticket items and long lead time items and those kinds of things, but it sure has an impact even on smaller stuff. And it can, the same thought process to change windows in my house with a little bit of rigor and with some real data on it can become really important for your organization.
Absolutely. So with that, I think we covered a variety of different aspects of life cycle cost, and I think we're nailing down what it is, how it works. There's a lot of detail going that goes in behind all that, but
that's right.
I think from a high-level view, we're good. But with your experience with these things, do you have any tips or words of wisdom you want to share with people who are trying to develop a life cycle model?
Well, we talked about it just briefly. I think I'd come back to that. Is a life cycle model has got, you can keep it really simple, right? For my windows, it's energy savings versus initial cost and installation, right? I'm not considering the factor of what's the repair rate of my old windows, because in the year we've been here, we've never had a failure. And from what I could tell from their construction, they never replaced one of those windows. And I don't expect the new windows to have a different response to this application. So we didn't include it. So there could have been 50 different things I included in that decision, and I think we only included 3 things. It stops the damage to the house, which we knew we had to invest in it at some point. But we thought, well, it would be good to do the energy savings. So it was 2 or 3 factors, and we went with it.
Yeah, so you picked the most important factors for your application or your operation or organization, if you will.
That's right.
And focused on those ones.
That's right. And if you don't have great data, how important is that particular assumption to the decision? So for us, it was, we knew the cost was roughly in the 10,000 range to get the new windows and get them installed. We didn't even run the calculations out on the energy savings lens, because we figured it was going to be quite a while before that paid for itself just on energy savings. But we didn't put a price on the comfort, because it gave us much more flexibility and use of the house. Now, when it comes down to hard, you're dealing with the finance group and budgets and stuff like that, we'll get a little bit more data. And sometimes you do need to get better information and get better data, and then you have to be a bit creative on it. But create the model and find out what data you need, and then focus on the ones that actually impact the decision. And don't worry about the ones that really don't make a big difference. You can make those explicitly assumptions, and here's the thought process behind it, and leave it at that, like we did with our windows. We thought, yep, we need to stop the damage. We know if we delay it, it's going to cost us more, because we'll have to replace timbers, and we don't want to do that. It's really expensive. And so I think that alone was enough to make us go ahead and do it. Adding the comfort with the added expense of the dual pane windows, we didn't look at it too hard.
Yep.
Absolutely. Right? But if you're doing $1 million piece of equipment, you may want to start thinking through what are all these factors, and then build get the finance people involved. But I think to answer your question, James, is the one piece of advice would be, is build a model, find out what you need to know, then go get that information. And if it, if you just don't have it, make an assumption, make it clear that it's an assumption and move on.
That's fair. I could, yeah, I agree with that. Now, what's the one thing you see done incorrectly with life cycle costing models?
Spend 3 years building it and never use it. you hire two guys and they go squirrel away for 3 years and nobody believes them and they never use it.
Now it sounds like an RCM analysis.
yeah. You can spend it, you can overanalyze it, right? I think the process, and it's like a lot of things we do, is start building credibility, because the acceptance, the culture around it, the we're bringing something new into the organization, and it'll be rejected just because it's different or new right away. So you got to start building its credibility, build the model, show that it's useful, celebrate the successes, do all those things. But yeah, if you're going to invest in building one, take due care to make sure it's successful. And that's one step at a time, one day at a time.
Excellent. Now, do you have any resources you can share with our listeners on this?
I think I do. I know I've written about lifecycle costing a couple of times and a couple of different models that went into it. So I'll have to look those up and send you a couple of links.
But they're on Ascendo, correct?
That's right. That's okay. Right.
And, you know, about this topic, there's one paper that I remember reading on this very topic, and it was very good. It covered a lot of these different pieces, and it was by Paul Barringer.
Oh, yeah, yeah. He would know this stuff, yeah.
He had an excellent paper on his website. I think it's Barringer1.com.
That's right.
And he had How Do You Build the Model? What Do You Look At? Provided a good example with different pumps or different setups. So, you know, one pump, two pumps in parallel, an upgraded pump with higher efficiency, all these different things. And he had a really good model. But he also had the spreadsheet model available within that.
Oh, you know, that all might still be there. I was talking to a couple of guys that they were at Rams that were basically taking over the site, and their idea was to keep all of that legacy there, and they were trying to sort out how they can maintain it and keep it up to date. Because Paul was brilliant at putting that all together.
He was. So I'll see if I can dig up those links as well and post those in here. But I'll make sure to include the Ascendo ones as well, so if you can get me those, I'll include those.
Will do.
Perfect. Now, Fred, as always, what else are you up to? Where can people find you? You mentioned in a previous conversation you're going to be at Rams.
That's right.
What else you got coming up before that?
Thanksgiving and Christmas, I think, is the holidays. I got a couple of clients' projects going on. I'm spending most of my time, though, on building out Ascendo Reliability, and that's where most people can find me any given day. It continues to grow. The downloads of the podcast continue to grow. The articles and the visits per day continues to expand. We're bringing on new authors. I'm hoping to bring on a couple more podcasts in the very near future. So it's courses. We're working real hard to, hopefully by the time this airs, we'll have a couple of courses posted on a variety of topics. And the list of what people have asked for, courses on reliability statistics, on fundamentals of FMEA, topics like that, it's become a pretty long list. And so I'm working with different authors and consultants to develop those courses and make them available. And then James, like with the work we're doing, is putting together webinars and more extensive webinars and making those more valuable to people to attend and participate in. So a lot going on with this Ascendo.
Yep. Perfect. Well, keep up the great work, Fred. I know I reference Ascendo on a regular basis and visit for a variety of articles you have on there. So,
all right, great, appreciate it, and thanks for contributing and being part of the network and all that good stuff. I really appreciate all the support you're providing to it.
It's absolutely. Well, Fred, I know it's getting probably around supper time for you, so I will let you go so you can grab a bite to eat.
All right, well, appreciate it, James. Pleasure talking to you as always.
All right, thanks, Fred.
Yeah, take care, James.
I would like to thank you for listening and remind you that you can always find out more on maintenance, reliability, and asset management at www.iridicio.com and by following our blog. The Rooted in Reliability podcast is a proud member of the Reliability.fm network. I'd like to ask you to please rate and review this podcast on iTunes or Stitcher. It ensures the podcast stays relevant and is easy to find by like-minded professionals. It is only with your ratings and reviews that the Rooted in Reliability podcast can continue to grow. I thank you for providing this small but critical support. We'll see you next week when we dive into another burning topic with Rooted in Reliability, your plant performance podcast.